attendant sheet. Some names from the previous group are already on the list, so just give a little tick. There's another one there, just pass them both around. If your name's not on there, just put it on the blank sheet.
I'm wondering where could I get the student handbook?
Good question. That you've got module one. Good to see a bit of eagerness. we're getting to that. So my name is Gangasar, for those who don't know. And once we've put our names in, we might just spend a couple of minutes just introduce ourselves to some of the new members, what have you. This week is an introductory lesson. I think there's also a retreat on the farm with Pallava Nambaswamy. I think that's this weekend. Yeah. So there, you know, there may be a few people that may come. Next week is Rath Yatra, so we won't have a class then. So we'll just get a start now and get everyone reading what they need to read, give everyone a bit of an understanding what they need to do, what the course is all about, and it gives you a couple of weeks to get into it, in which case we come back in 2 weeks' time, will be the next lesson. And of course, we're doing module two, and module two consists of the Srimad Bhagavatam, fourth canto, the sixth canto. And we have already done in module one, cantos one to three. Now, last year, we had everyone gets one of these, the Bhakti Bhai Bhava handbook. This is the one for module one, and the one for module two is very similar. And of course, so each module has 12 units, so we've done 12 units, and within each unit there's four or five lessons. So we're up to unit 13, and we'll go up to unit 24. All of the units, of course, are, some people may like to just sit in and not do the exams. I'm quite happy for people to do that if they want. Some people do the written exams where there's 10 questions at the end of each unit. Some people do that and the essays, about 4 essays of about 250 to 300 words at the end of each unit. So some people like to do the exams and the essays. Some might do, but whatever you do, we note down a record so that each unit you do is recorded, and then if you go back and want to do any of the other units that you've missed out on, then the units you've already done you don't have to do again, of course. Now, when we come closer to the time for exams, for those who haven't done them before, we can give a little bit more information then. But I won't scare you too much now. the class from 2012 know how tough I am in the exams. So beware. I'm going to at the end of the class, we'll get everyone who wants one of the books. They usually cost about $25, and it has, for each unit, we might cover a few chapters. There are some questions, usually about 10 to 15 questions, and they're homework questions. As you're going through, you just try and answer those questions, usually from the purports or the translations. And the exams that we do, we select 10 of those questions. Right? So there might be about 30 questions that you do over the unit, and we'll select 10 of them, and they'll be in the exam. And then each unit has about 4 questions where you write essays. These books also have a summary of each chapter, the main parts of the chapter, like that. And that's pretty much it. There are sometimes different tables. There's one we're going to use today that where diagrams are necessary to help. There's one we're going to use about the genealogical table of the daughters of Manu, like that. There is another book which we can do, is Prabhupada Quotes, although I don't know if we have that for module 2. I'll have a look. I'm not sure if they actually supplied one. You see at the back of the books there are slokas that can be learned. There are key slokas. So for module 2, there's 14 slokas from cantos 4, 5 and 6. And there's 18 slokas from the Brahma Samhita. So, somewhere, whenever a devotee is ready to be tested, they really just need to come and quote those, the Sanskrit, the translation, and then we mark those. Okay. Alright, now everyone's we've filled out this, so perhaps we can just go around and we'll just introduce ourselves quickly. Just say your name, quick hello if you want to say something about yourself. Start from Beske.
I'm back from. This is more to feel. I don't know what to say about myself.
Hare
Krishna. I'm Navin.
That's it. Full stop.
Hare Krishna. I'm Prabhu Parasamya Prabhu. Sorry, Vikas. Please bless me for the knowledge that I'll be recording from my bishop over the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And your sidekick there?
He's also a member. He's a member.
My name is Vasudev.
Krishna.
My name is Bhakti Sada. I've gained a lot from attending these Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav classes. So I hope to deepen my understanding of Krishna consciousness in this next part.
Hare Krishna, I'm Surya Gopal Das. I would, as Sridhar Prabhu said, I would also like to improve my knowledge from Canto 4 onwards by the grace of Yageshwar Prabhu. I hope I can understand something.
Hare Krishna, my name is Gopal Das. I have been attending Swami Sadri and Bhakti Vaibhav Sri Krishna. And I couldn't finish all of the work, so this time I hope I can really catch up with everything and you know, keep going.
What year did we start? The ones that did Bhakti Shastri, what year did we start then?
2009,
was it? Yeah. 2007. 2007? Yeah.
I think it's
my name.
Is that the one drop out? Either the one drop.
I started with Anirudh and
I was doing.
Yeah, I started with
that.
So that was about
2007.
Yeah, yeah.
Anirudh did the first half,
yes.
And then you did the second half,
yeah.
And that, the night start from 2007,
yeah.
April.
1 year there was a break or something? There was a break?
Yeah,
something
from there. I'm Srimurti, very good. The servant of Gaudiya Bhakti, his wife. And I'm very happy to be here in the association of people who want to absorb themselves in Krishna Katha.
I'm Janani Divyadasi, and I'm just crashing the party. Sorry.
That's all right, yeah.
So it's a pleasure to come and listen to the Gangeshwar Prabhu. I've missed him. I've seen him for a long time. And the association of his beautiful wife, Sri Vedi. Missed her a lot too.
Oh, and our beautiful Christy to my right as well. Introduce me. So, hey, Krishna, I'm Chris Cook. Let me tell you. Hoping to continue for as long as possible during these wonderful classes. And I'd just like to say thank you to Ganga and to all the devotees for their association.
Hare Krishna, my name is Krishna Devadasi. First of all, I would like to thank the Gangeshwar Prabhu for bearing with us for all the mistakes we were doing. And I humbly ask you to give your blessing so that we can take it at least the second module seriously. And
Hare Krishna, my name is Kiti Lakshana Devi Rasi, and as Krishna, you know, if you want to be like that, I would also like to be more punctual in the classes and to be on time with my assignments and to say well to each other.
Hare Krishna. All right. we may get to, you know, a few more coming in. I think Gokula Rani. I meant to call her because she wanted to do Canto 4. So I have to call her. I was going to try and call her before today, but I didn't get around to her. But I think Gokula Rani wants to come along and you know, there are a few others. Okay, so everyone's got their name there. And of course, you know, there's Smriti comes in. And what's that?
Janavid
has just had a baby, but she'll be coming in. Yeah, so there are.
I also heard Nirmala is also coming.
Yeah. Yeah. You mean today or?
They said today.
Yeah, yeah, because they're back from India.
Yeah, they already back
yeah.
Last week. Yeah.
Our patient is Ananta Viradas, and I came halfway last year. In year 9, but I've learned a lot and I hope to continue to go as far as I can, and please forgive any offenses.
Hi, Vishnu. My name is Pritam. Really sorry, I couldn't take permission before attending this. I'm new to Krishna consciousness. And wherever I'm getting a chance, I just want to attend and listen to Krishna.
So you got your name down here? Do you want to put it on?
I think it's a structure program or something.
What's that?
It's a structure program, right?
Well, it's up to you. You know, you can put your name down. If you come occasionally, you can put your name down. And, you know, if you decide it's only going to be casual and you pop in now and then, that's okay. But do you want to? So. New boy just walked in. We're just introducing ourselves.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my name is Sri Ramda. So I just came to look here.
Very good. Let me off the hook. Some of the casuals ended up staying, so I just get the name just in case, you know. Some of them get hooked in. You'd be surprised at how many were a bit casual. Okay. Now, what we do, of course, let me just read first a paragraph from, I think it's the the first sloka. So now, who's got a Bhagavatam with them? Yep. Good. Or an iPad. Yes. Prabhupada in this text, Sri Maitreya says, Swayambhuva Muni begot three daughters and his wife, Satarupa. And the names were Akuti, Devahuti, and Prasuti. Prabhupada mentions that, first of all, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto our spiritual master, Om Vishnupad, Sri Shamad Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada, by whose order I am engaged in this Herculean task of writing commentary on the Srimad Bhagavatam as the Bhaktivedanta purports. By his grace we have finished three cantos already, and we are just trying to begin the fourth canto. By his divine grace, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto Lord Chaitanya, who began this Krishna consciousness movement. Of Bhagavad Dham 500 years ago, and through his grace let us offer our obeisances to the six Goswamis, and then let us offer our obeisances to Radha and Krishna, the spiritual couple who enjoy eternally in Vrindavan with their cowherd boys and damsels in Brajabhumi. Let us also offer our respectful obeisances to all the devotees and eternal servitors of the Supreme Lord. So, this is the same mood in which Srila Prabhupada is writing the Srimad Bhagavatam. That is the same mood in which we are trying to study it. Prabhupada, he calls it a Herculean task, of course, because he is writing the purports. At the same time as, managing an entire movement. And he's saying that he's doing this by the order of his spiritual master. That order, of course, came through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his disciples, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. So Prabhupada is, writing the commentaries, translating the Srimad Bhagavatam on their order. And he is doing that because their order is to engage everyone in activities simply for the pleasure of Radha and Krishna and all the residents of Vrindavan and all the devotees and eternal servitors of the Supreme Lord. So, that's the our motivation as well. That, this order to, understand, teach, distribute this knowledge of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that is the Sankirtan movement, that comes down, and that's what we accept that order as well, all of us. Really we have no other purpose to fulfill except just to do our duty. We are eternal servants of the Supreme Lord, and this is the message of Godhead, or the message of the Supreme Lord, and you know, our duty is simply to receive it and distribute it. So really, that's our only purpose. We have no other purpose in doing that. You know, we have no attempt for any, you know, gain, you know, in a subtle way, or, you know, in a material way. You know, if we can execute that order, then we would do that. And of course, Prabhupada calls it a Herculean task, and you know, I think most of the devotees who have, you know, done the Bhakti Shastri and you know, the module 1, or even parts of module 1, or, you know, they know, you know, how difficult it is to, you know, study, you know, in a systematic way and properly understand this to the point where one becomes confident and you know, qualified to then give that knowledge as it is nicely, you know, to other people. It's a big task, and it's a Herculean task, you know, from it. But so sometimes that is very, very difficult. Sometimes it is done with great pleasure, but we follow this mood of Prabhupada that it's a service, you know, it's a duty that we do. Through the good times, through the bad times, you know, it's just something we do as an eternal servitor of Krishna, like that. So this is the mood that Prabhupada starts this Bhagavatam, and this is the mood in which we're going to, you know, present this module 2, like that. So let's begin. And of course, let me introduce, a lot of people ask me if I'm ever going to have a son. Yes, I now have a son. I'd like to introduce you to Govardhan Lal.
Born 4th of December
2012, sorry. He was our spiritual master Shailendra Jumna Goswami Maharaj climbed the Govardhan Hill and, you know, personally selected this particular Govardhan. And when he found him, he thought, okay, we'll keep this one for, you know, Srimati Ganga and Bruni. And he passed that to Bruni to give to her parents. And he said that we should treat him as our son, and that she should treat him as her little brother. So how many days? He's December
the
4th. So
7 months.
Yeah, he's about
2 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he will be coming to visit from time to time. So he likes the Bhagavatam as well, because some of his favourite stories are in there. All right. Now, there's a nice overview also in the purport in the first chapter of this fourth canto. There are descriptions of the three daughters of Svayambhuva Manu and their descendants. The next six chapters describe the sacrifice performed by King Daksha and how it was spoiled. Thereafter, the activities, so, you know, this is pretty much what we'll be getting into today. We'll do chapter 1, chapter 2. Chapter 1, you know, one take is a lot to go through. Chapter 2, there's some very nice, you know, topics in there. The next six chapters describe the sacrifice performed by King Daksha and how it was called. Thereafter, the activities of Maharaj Dhruva are described in five chapters. Then in 11 chapters, the activities of King Prithu are described, and the next 8 chapters are devoted to the activities of the Vachetya King. So that's Canto 4. An overview there. Who would like to describe some of the main themes that we have discussed in module 1. Just see how we go from memory. Module 1, so we just bridge the gap to where we are now, just very, very quickly. I'll start off, because I've got the book here. But we first of all hear the glories of the Srimad Bhagavatam itself. And to understand the glories of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we're introduced to the various speakers and hearers of the Bhagavatam. We hear Narada Muni's instructions to Vyas. We hear about Vyasadeva and his relationship to Sukadeva Goswami, who becomes the next speaker of the Bhagavatam. And we hear about the relationship between Sukadeva Goswami and Suda Goswami, who then spoke the Srimad Bhagavatam. We also hear about Sukadeva Goswami and Prigit Maharaj, and then Suda Goswami. So these are the various hearers and reciters of the Bhagavatam, and in hearing their enormous qualifications of these saintly persons who are the best among all the sages and saints within the universe, worshipped even by the demigods. We understand that the literature which they're focused upon, as the topmost literature, is the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it helps us to understand that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the very cream of all Vedic literatures. We come into the Srimad Bhagavatam just after the Battle of Kurukshetra. We hear about, we hear the prayers of Queen Kunti and the prayers of Bhishma Dev, and we're introduced to the Pandavas, and of course a lot of that, and then there's where Parikit Maharaj was almost killed within the womb. So a lot of those activities, we're introduced to the Pandavas and the scene just after the Battle of Kurukshetra, because that helps us to understand, it leads up to the setting of the scene of Parikit Maharaj speaking the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because in order to get to that point, we have to understand that the Pandavas retire, Dhritarashtra and Gandhari retire to the forest, and that leaves Parikit Maharaj, who has been trained up to rule the world after being saved within the womb of Krishna, and then he becomes bitten by the snake bird, and to die within 7 days, and then he decides to fast until death, and then Sukadeva Goswami speaks the Bhagavatam to him. So Maharaj Parikit chastises Kali, and gradually we begin to hear of Sukadeva Goswami reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, and there is a description of various different yoga processes, beginning from meditation on the universal form of the Lord, and gradually taking us through meditation upon the super soul within the heart, and gradually developing a theme of bhakti, hearing and chanting is the topmost process like that. We're introduced to the characters of Vidura, Uddhava and Maitreya, this also, their story also takes up you know, just prior to Krishna's departure and then just after Krishna's departure, some very confidential instructions that Krishna gave to Uddhava, which then Maitreya Muni overheard and spoke those to Vidura. So, you know, much of the conversation we hear in this third canto is, you know, the conversation between third canto and fourth canto, and I think into the fifth as well, is, you know, the conversation between, you know, Maitreya and Vidura, like that. Their conversation takes us into a discussion on creation. You know, going from the very first day of Lord Brahma, even before that, we hear about you know, Saga creation, or literally Mahavishnu glancing over the material energy, and you know, the time factor energizing the material energy, and the Lord impregnating through his glance the living entities within the material energy. Gradually, the universe is the 24 elements of the universal creation become manifest. So this is all part of the primary creation of the initial universal elements, along with the jiva and time. And then we hear of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu gradually enters within the universe, and entering within the universe, then we hear about secondary creation with a universal form being manifested within the universe. Gradually, Lord Brahma appearing from Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, like this, and then what happens is that towards the end of the third canto, so there's a lot there in the second and third cantos about creation, you know, primary and secondary, and then the Purusha Shukta prayers, which are, you know, happened at that time, at the beginning of creation. And then we hear about Brahma creating the different, 14 planetary systems, which are in a somewhat a blueprint or a subtle form within the lotus that has come from Garbhadakshaya Vishnu's navel. And the Lord Brahma began to create various beings within the universe by shedding off different aspects of his shadow and, you know, different parts of his subtle body. 10 sons were born, including the Radha Muni. At that stage, he was also thinking of, he was still, you know, meditating that he really wanted to expand the population of the universe. And at that time, Swayambhuva, Manu, and Satarupa appeared. So Swayambhuva Manu, the first Manu, Satarupa, did he appear along with him? I think they did. They both appeared together. Yeah, that's right. They both appeared together. They had 5 children. Priyavata, Uttanapad, Devahuti, Akuti, and Prasuti. So then, what happened was that we begin to hear in the third canto about, you know, the descendants from Swayambhuva Manu and Satarupa, beginning with Devahuti, and she marries Kadama Muni, which is one of the 10 sons of Brahma, and from Devahuti and Kadama Muni, Kapila was born, and therefore most of the third canto is then taken up with many, many instructions about Lord Kapila. Right, so that's, you know, just a brief summary of, you know, what we've done so far. So now where we're taking off is that let's have a look at the other descendants from Swayam Buddha. And here we're particularly looking at the daughters. So we've looked at Devahuti to some degree. I think we look at a little bit more here. And then we look at the descendants of Akuti and Prasuti. So that's what we're doing now. And pretty much as we hear about those descendants in the first chapter here, then as we get to the last slope, we realize that one of those descendants is Sati, who marries Shiva, and describes that although she is young and served her husband faithfully, still she never had children. And so the question is asked, why is that? And then we hear about the Daksha Jagya, where she's given up her body while still young, and therefore never had the opportunity to have children, and that leads us into the Daksha Jagya of that. Okay, so that's that's where we start. Alright. Now, any questions or now, who's read chapter 1? Right. Just about everyone? Very good. Alright. So, let's go over it again. Now, so it describes here, as you may have noticed, that towards the end of the chapter describes it. Anyone who reads this with faith becomes free from all sin. Who's free from all sin? Okay. So, the three daughters, Akuti, Devahuti, and Prasuti. And the two sons were? Priyavata and Dhanapada. Now, Akuti had two brothers. Hare Krishna. Now, but in spite of her brothers, Swayambhuva handed her over to Prajapati Ruchi on the condition that the son born of her be returned to Manu as his son. This he did in consultation with his wife, Satyarupa. So this is called Putrika Dharma. Putrika Dharma means what? Putrika Dharma.
Well, it's a religious ritual where father. I'll let it lead to you.
No, go on. No, you're on the right track.
Well, it's a bit confusing. The father, even though he has two sons, because he wants the Lord to be his son, he gives the daughter away so that she can conceive the son, so that
his grandson.
And his grandson then becomes
one of
his
sons. Yeah, yeah. He accepts him as his own. Yeah, that's right. So it's a it's a custom according to which is acceptable that. In ancient India anyway, but a person may desire a particular son and they give their daughter in marriage to a certain purpose, with the understanding that that person knows that, okay, the first son will be given to the, you know, father of the daughter.
And because
Swayambhu is
the father of mankind, that then became a principle.
Yes, it becomes a principle, that's right. And because Manu, you know, writes the law books of mankind, so he understood. What is unusual is that he understood that he had two sons, so it's unusual. It's very unusual if you've got two sons that you'll be doing that. Usually if someone doesn't have a son, they might do that. The reason he did it was such an unusual thing because he knew that the offspring would actually be the Supreme Personality of the Godhead. So, you know. So that's why he did it. So, but, you know, there are many tribes and races of people who actually, this is a very common practice, that the first male or, you know, or daughter even, you know, born of the, you know, girl is brought up by the grandparents. I think the Maoris, you know, is very common amongst the Maoris, and I think some other, you know, it's a Vedic thing that's, you know, obviously one of the things that has taken off in many different races. It's not such an uncommon thing. And if you actually read through Prabhupada's book, you'll see that, especially in a lifetime in preparation, many times Prabhupada, you know, he mentions how he would ask, you know, you give me, you know, you have so many sons, give me one. And you know, I can, you know, then he can be my disciple and we can preach. So he was, you know, you give me one son, like that, you know. And when I read that, I thought, you know, it was such an unusual thing. You know, you might ask someone for a little bit of help or, you know, a little bit of donation, you know. Imagine someone dropping their son off in the donation box. You know? But... you know, that's your problem. You know, give me your son. You know, he's a nice boy, good looking boy. In fact, he's out. You can help preach like that.
What is unusual is asking from the daughter, because actually, according to even Vedic thing, that you give the daughter off, so the daughter no longer belongs to you.
Mm.
So, normally the daughter, the thing could be taken by the in laws of the boy's side, yes.
Yeah.
The boy's side may take.
Yes.
That is different, but the girl's
side
cannot take.
Mm.
That is
okay, so that makes it more unusual as well.
Because normally the girl's side have no right.
Yeah, okay. So there's a couple of things that are slightly unusual.
Different. Mm. I was very surprised when I read that.
Right. Okay. There's another interesting point there. Mm. That is one of the questions, of course. A lot of the things sometimes... some of these things, you know, Putrika Dharma, I wanted to photocopy some things for you, but I wasn't sure how many people would turn up today. But, at the end of today, or somewhere before we pack up, what I want to do is to photocopy all the pages that you'll need, you know, from the handbook for this year to do the first unit. So there's about, you know, five lessons, a month's work, maybe more, a couple of months' work. It'll be all the questions you're asked. You know, some of the ones I'm highlighting here are some of the questions, some of the answers to the questions. Just before we go today, just remind me to do those handouts for you. And then, in some stage, I'll also try and get you, you know, we'll get the books made up, and also some people may like the, you know, soft copy. USB sticks. So... So Akuti had two brothers, so we read that. Ruchi was very powerful in his Brahminical qualifications. He was anointed one of the progenitors of the living entities. He begot one son and one daughter by his wife, Akuti. Of the two children born of Akuti, the male child was directly an incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and his name was Jagya, which is another name of Lord Vishnu. The female child is a partial incarnation of Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, the eternal consort of Lord Vishnu. Swayambhuva Manu very gladly brought home the beautiful boy named Jagya, and Ruchi, his son-in-law, kept with him the daughter Dakshina. The lord of the ritualistic performance of Jagya later married Dakshina, who was anxious to have the personality of Godhead as her husband. And in this wife, the lord who was also very much pleased to beget 12 children. So, although apparently brother and sister, their spiritual relationship as the lord and his eternal consort was actually unchanged. That is the real relationship there. So they had 12 children. Very, very nice purport here about the relationship between a husband and wife. It says that an ideal husband and wife are generally called Lakshmi Narayan to compare them to the Lord and the Goddess of Fortune. For it is significant that Lakshmi Narayan are forever happy as husband and wife. So whenever I do a wedding, there's a prayer there, and when they tie the knot, at that point when we tie the knot, there's a prayer and we recite all the names, Lakshmi Narayan, Sitaram, Radha Krishna. We want the couple to be compared to the Lord. Not in the sense that they're God, but in the sense of how they cooperate nicely to be happy. That's the real goal. As much as they can follow the footsteps of the Lord and his consort, to that degree they'll be happy. That's why we compare them. You know, mentioned in there, Kamsa and his wife, Ravana and his wife. Even the demons get in on that list, because you know as a married couple. They were just, you know, unbreakable, you know, and just worked together. So, you know, looked after each other, you know, whatever circumstances they found themselves in, that relationship between the husband and wife was, you know, just not meant to be broken. That's, now, a wife should always remain satisfied with her husband, and a husband should always remain satisfied with his wife. In the Chanakya Sloka, the moral instruction of Chanakya Pandit, it is said that if a husband and wife are always satisfied with one another, then the goddess of fortune automatically comes. In other words, when there is no disagreement between husband and wife, all material opulence is present and good children are born. So, you know, this is a very... Prabhupada quoted this in the Chanakya Pandit Sloka a lot, that you know, when the husband and wife don't quarrel, then, as Prabhupada puts it, you know, the goddess of fortune, she thinks, oh, this is a nice place for me to reside. And you know, when there's, I mean, all husbands and wives quarrel, so, you know, that's but you know, when it becomes, Prabhupada gives the example of the quarrel between a husband and wife, that he tells the story of the Himalayan mountains. You know, there was the Himalayan mountains started to rumble and shake, and there were big loud noises, and everyone, you know, gathered, you know, the foothills of the Himalayas to see what was going to happen, and you know, because a big commotion like that, and then out from the bottom of the Himalayas, this little, you know, half a dozen rats, you know, ran out and ran into the bushes, and everyone was like, you know. You know, it was a bit of a fizzle, you know, there was a big noise and nothing really happened. So Prabhupada always compares, you know, the normal quarrelling between husband and wife like that. Oh, I'm going to leave you and I'll never have anything to do with you again. You know, they say so many things, but in the long run, you know, nothing actually happens. You know, it's like 2 hours later, you know, sitting down having a drink together. So, you know, that's a different thing. But, you know, when there's, they actually can't live together, you know, the quarrel is like that, and they separate like that. You know, the goddess of fortune leaves. And you see that, you know, with couples, just all the, you know, especially, you know, the goddess of fortune leaves. I know where she goes. To the lawyers. That's her new residence. Yeah. That's where she hangs out. So, so the 12, it describes the names of the 12 boys born of Jagya and Dakshina. Now, during the time of Swayambhuva Manu, these sons all became the demigods, collectively named the Tushitas. Narichi became the head of the seven rishis, and Yagya became the king of the demigods Indra. So Yagya became Indra.
So this is all happening in Satyaja, in the Deva, in the king.
Yes. Yeah. This is all happening in Satyayuga, and we're right at the beginning of Brahma's day. And as far as we can understand, this is the first day of Brahma in the second half of his life. That means in his 51st year of life, his first day, which is this day. Right? So this day that we're living in, Brahma's day, his current day is when this is taking place, but we're going back, so we're now in the seventh Manu, is it?
Yeah.
Seventh Manu, yeah. There are 14 Manus in the day of Brahma. In the seventh Manu, Vaivasvata Manu. And so that means six have passed, Swayambhuva is the first. So here we're describing that Yagya becomes Indra. So he's actually the personality of Godhead, and he becomes Indra, and we'll see that many of his different sons become, you know, the various demigods and whatever like that.
And actually, here
that
Jagya is the Lord himself,
so
he's the
governor
of that particular
Jiva. So sometimes, you know, the one incarnation can be Yuga avatar, you know, Manvantara avatar, you know, and Leela avatar. Sometimes, you know, but they can coincide. Yeah.
So it's
still the same day of Brahma, just going back 6 months. Yes. On the second half of his life, but yeah. First day. Yeah. So, now, as far as I understand from the 8th canto, is that at the change of every Manu, when there's a partial dissolution, then, you know, they appoint a new Indra, and, you know, new seven rishis, and you know, there's a change of these various demigods like that. So, therefore, you may hear some past times of Indra that you wouldn't associate with the Lord being that particular Indra, you know, and like that. So they're not the same. You know, we have to understand that many different pastimes of Indra may be referring to different Indras, you know, in this day and even from other days. So during the time of Svayam Bhuva Manu, these sons all become demigods, collectively named the Tushitas. Marichi became the head of the seven rishis, so they always appoint seven rishis. Jagga became king of the demigods, Indra. Now, his two sons, Priyavrata and Uttanapada, we'll hear about them later. They become very powerful kings, and their sons and grandsons spread all over the three worlds during that period. Now, Swami Bhuvamanu handed over his very dear daughter Devahuti to Kadama Muni, and we've heard about that in the previous canto. He handed over his daughter Prasuti to the son of Brahma named Daksha. So Daksha is also one of the progenitors of the living entities, and his descendants spread throughout the three worlds. So this is how the world is becoming popular, and later we'll hear a little bit more about those descendants. Now, going back to... we heard how there were nine daughters of Kadama Muni and Devahuti. And they were handed over to nine different sages. So please hear about this. From so we've heard a little bit about Devahuti, Prakuti and Prasuti. Now we're going back to Devahuti, but now her daughters. So, I'm not going to go through all of these. I think, you know, you can just read a lot of these, you know, in your own time. And there are some. But let's, you know, particularly take up with Mantra 15 about Anasuya, the wife of Atri Muni. So this is one of the daughters of Devahuti. She gave birth to three very famous sons, Soma, the moon god, Dattatreya, and Durvasa, who are partial representations of Lord Vishnu, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. Soma was a partial representation of Lord Brahma, Dattatreya was a partial representation of Lord Vishnu, and Durvasa was a partial representation of Lord Shiva. Srila Prabhupada, it's a very nice verse there. It describes, you know, how Brahman is the gradations of Brahman. So you may have the full powerhouse, and then, you know, certain light bulbs may reflect just, you know, certain gradations of Brahman, more or less. And therefore, you know, Dattatreya representing Lord Vishnu would represent, you know, a greater gradation of Brahman than that of Devasa and Soma.
What do you mean by partial representation? What is the meaning?
It means it's an expansion. As it describes here, that... you know, Dattatreya is an expansion of Vishnu. And uh, Devasa is an expansion of Lord Shiva. And Soma is a partial representation of Brahma, representing the Jiva, who may be somewhat, you know, empowered by Lord Brahma.
Does it mean that it's a
Saktivesha avatar is generally a living entity who is empowered by the Lord. Soma, you know, is a living entity who is empowered by Lord Brahma. So, you know, I haven't seen that he's mentioned as a Saktivesha avatar. And Devasa is empowered by Lord Shiva. And, you know, Dattatreya, if he was a Jiva empowered by Vishnu, you would say he was a Saktivesha avatar. But he's actually an expansion of Vishnu. Sometimes the expansions of Vishnu are considered to be Saktivesha avatar, as in the case of, you know, Ananta Sesha. And another one, something like that. Rishabh.
Rishabh.
I think so. But no, I haven't seen anywhere that any of those are mentioned as Saktivesha avatar.
I think Prithu Maharaj is Saktivesha.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, you know, Vidura asked Maitreya how these three deities, you know, appeared and then became the offspring of Atrimuni. And we hear how Atrimuni, desiring to create different offspring, he prayed for the Lord of creation to appear. He wanted a son just like the Lord of creation. He didn't ask for the Lord of creation, he asked for a son just like the Lord of creation, and therefore his desire was not considered a spiritual desire, but a material desire. He was not desiring the absolute truth, but relative truth, something like the absolute truth. And the relative truth, of course, is the material aspect of reality. He wasn't sure who is the Lord of creation, because you know, Vishnu, Shiva, and Brahma, that, you know, one's seen to be maintaining, one's creating, one's destroying. In that sense, you could say, well, he's the Lord, or he's the Lord, you know. And, you know, they did have different qualifications. So he just wasn't sure, you know, because of the various qualifications, which one. And he thought it would be one of them, but he didn't know which one. So they all appeared. I've also seen, you know, in some descriptions that, you know, there's a little bit more to Dattatreya, where sometimes he's actually considered the combined form. You know, have you heard that? Yeah. Who's heard that, where Dattatreya is considered to be the combined form of all three? Anyone else?
I think it says it in here, actually.
Yeah, it does.
It says it in page 14, or text 15.
It is.
But it's a three-time one, then three.
Well, it's saying there are three sons. Is there anywhere it says there's one son where all three combined?
I think it is.
I think it's in another canto. Yeah. Because, you know, it mentions three sons, three very famous sons, it says in the translation in the Bible. But, you know, elsewhere, there are descriptions that Dattatreya is the combined form of those. Have you heard that? Yeah. I've read that as well.
Dattatreya is
Here is describing Dattatreya as Vishnu Tattva. I have read where he's considered, you know, some consider him to be the, it might be from one of the Puranas or something like that. He's considered to be the combined form of Vishnu, Shiva and Brahma. Now, I think many people in India
consider him. Therefore, the words Atmasesha Brahma Samvaran indicate
that Jatamaya was directly part of Vishnu, whereas Dubhasha Sarva was part of Vishnu. That's right, yeah. So you know that's possible that he can also be because see from Vishnu come Shiva and Brahma, therefore if Dattatreya is an expansion of Vishnu, then the expansions of Shiva and Brahma can be incorporated. But you can't say that the expansion of Brahma or the expansion of Shiva. So, you know, it's not incorrect to also say because he's an expansion of Vishnu, therefore he can also simultaneously be the expansion of, have the qualities. Because, you know, it's mentioned in that purport that Lord Vishnu has a certain amount of qualities, Lord Shiva has slightly less qualities, and Lord Brahma has less qualities. So, it's mentioned, I think, in the Nectar Devotion that there are 64 qualities of Krishna. Of those, the first 50 that living entity or the jivas have, minutely. But Lord Brahma has them in greater quantity, and as do the pure devotees. The next five qualities, which are there in Krishna, are also found in Brahma and Shiva, but in greater quantity in Shiva than Brahma. The next five qualities of Krishna are found in Lord Vishnu. And even in greater quantity in Lord Narayan. And the next four qualities are only found in, you know, Lord Krishna. Therefore, if one is an expansion of Vishnu, all 60 qualities are there, which means that that person has the qualities of being an expansion of Vishnu, Shiva and Brahma. You know, they're there. But if someone is an expansion of Brahma, they would only have the 50 qualities. That means there is some missing like that. So, you know, it's you can accept Dattatreya also in that respect as, you know, an expansion of all three. He has the qualities of all three.
What is the actual difference between expansion and evolution?
Well, expansion means that Lord Vishnu, we accept that Dattatreya as Lord Vishnu. Although Dattatreya may not manifest as fully all the qualities of Vishnu, but would manifest more qualities than Shiva. So we So Dattatreya is accepted as incarnation of Vishnu, which means that he's as good as Vishnu in all respects, but he may not manifest that potency fully. Therefore, in the Brahma Samhita, it describes that, you know, there are many incarnations of the Lord, and they're considered to be like one candle lights another candle. That each candle has equal candle power, but one is the original. So when we say, therefore Prabhupada will often say in his books and his lectures that there is no difference between Lord Ramchandra and Krishna. They are equal. You know, they are equal in power. It's the same person. Lord Ramchandra doesn't manifest the full qualities and potency that Krishna does, but it doesn't mean he doesn't have that full potency. Lord Vishnu doesn't manifest the full potencies and power as Lord Narayana, but it doesn't mean he doesn't have those qualities or potency. So it's just one candle is you know, lighting the next one. So they're considered equal. Okay. But although they're equal, sometimes they may not fully manifest that full potency. So, you know, you can, for instance, in the case with Lord Shiva, Lord Shiva, you know, you can get a candle and you can put a, you know, what do you call it, cover. So it's the same candle power, but it's been dimmed. You don't need the full light. It'd be like, you know, you can buy a reading lamp, and it's just on dusk. And you can press the switch and just one bar lights up. And then you get to the dead of the night, you press the switch and, you know, it fully lights up. So it's like that full power is there, but it's not always needed. Shiva is compared to a candle where there's a lot of soot on the cover. And therefore, you know, it's somewhat slightly limited. But, anyway.
Okay, but that's the case with incarnations, but in expansions, like, is it that they really don't have all the qualities? Whereas incarnations do, but they don't manifest. Is that the difference? Or?
They have the same potency.
Yeah, but they may not
they may not manifest it. That's and therefore, not manifesting it, their qualities may appear to be somewhat different.
Yeah, but incarnations.
Yeah.
So,
well, all the expansions of the Lord are like that. You know,
yeah.
Incarnation means that they descend. You know, their expansions of the Lord, and these expansions have their own planets, spiritual planets, or Vaikuntha planets. And when they descend, they descend as an avatar. And, you know, the avatar may not necessarily manifest the same full potency that the Lord manifests on his Vaikuntha planet, even though he can. He's operating in a different atmosphere where it may not be just a little, you know, a little raising the eyebrows enough rather than a good boost. Dattatreya is a very unusual personality because in many of the writings you see that our acharyas and even Srila Prabhupada and in the Bhagavad Gita, he's considered to be an impersonalist. You know, preaching Mayavada philosophy, and therefore he's rejected in the same way, along with Buddha. You know that Vaishnavas don't follow his. But then you see that in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that Dattatreya is known to be the Avaduta, and we, you know, take we study many chapters, you know, practically the entire 11th canto. There's about 30 odd chapters, and it's about 20 of them are all devoted to the teachings of Dattatreya, the Avadhuta, his different teachings. He's discussing with the Navayogendras, I think.
The teachings of the
Avadhuta. The teachings of the Avadhuta, that's right. So, So sometimes you read about Dattatreya and you know, he's just literally rejected as, you know, someone that Vaishnavas don't follow. And then other times, you know, you'll read that he's, you know, we follow very strictly the teaching.
Sorry, does it mean that the Avadhuta in the 11th canto is
the same person? But you know, he has a I guess when he's in, you know, teaching his Mayavad philosophy, he's sort of acting in that role like an expansion, you know, being, if he's the expansion of Vishnu, Shiva and Brahma, it's almost like the role of Shiva coming out more in his teachings, and whereas, you know, in his Vishnu role of maintaining religious principles for Vaishnavas, he has may have other teachings. So we follow him in that mood, and he may have other, you know, teachings just for, you know, Karma Kanda type teachings, which may be more in the mood of the Lord Brahma. So, as we go through here, so we can skip through some of them. You see that some of these descendants are. You know, we have Brihaspati and Kavera and the Yakshas. Ravana, Kumbhakarna, you know, in verse 37 you see that Visrava had two wives. The first wife was Idavida, from whom Kavera, the master of all Yakshasas, were born. And the next wife was named Kishini, from whom three sons were born, Ravana, Kumbhakarna and Vibhishan. So you see how far the Ramayan goes back. Verse 37. Well, that's when they were born. Ravana, Kumbhakarna, Vibhishan.
But Ramayan took place in Treta. But that's the other one, isn't it? From this one.
Yeah, the so, you know, but they were obviously living way back then. We must have
for millions of years.
Kratu's wife Kriya gave birth to 60,000 great sages named the Valakilyas. All these sages were greatly advanced in spiritual knowledge, and their bodies were illuminated by such knowledge. As far as I understand, as mentioned in the 12th canto, that these Vatikilyas are the same ones that accompany the sun god. 60,000 great sages. Chitraketu is born. And from Makanda, Markandeya Muni was born. And Kavi. So in verse 47 it describes that the population was thus increased by the descendants of these sages and the daughters of Kadama. Anyone who hears the descriptions of this dynasty with faith will be relieved from all sinful reactions. Another of Manu's daughters, known as Prasuti, married the son of Brahma, named Daksha. Daksha begot 16 very beautiful daughters with lotus-like eyes in his wife. So this is where we lead into the next chapter. Of these 16 daughters, 13 were given in marriage to Dharma, and one daughter was given to Agni. Now, it describes there that in this list of descendants, there's Murti and Dharma, I think it is, and they gave birth to Naranarayana Rishi. So, also going way back then, Naranarayana Rishi appeared, and as Prabhupada mentions in purport of 56, that in the present day, Naranarayana Rishi have appeared in the form of Krishna and Arjuna. So, Naranarayana Rishi is a twin incarnations. Nara is a living entity, and Narayan is Narayan, or you know, Vishnu Tattva. And they appear together. And they departed and resided at Gandhamadana Hill. And in verse 59 we see that Naranarayana Rishi, who is a partial expansion of Krishna, has now appeared in the dynasties of Yadu and Kuru in the forms of Krishna and Arjuna respectively to mitigate the burden of the world. So it describes there in the translation. various different fire gods, 49 different fire gods were manifested. These 49 fire gods are the beneficiaries of the oblations offered in the Vedic sacrificial fire by impersonalist Brahmanas, as was mentioned there in verse 62. You know, we understand, of course, that all Vedic sacrifices are meant to please Jagya or Vishnu, and when we chant the Om, it's representing Vishnu. Some Brahmanas, when they chant the Gayatri Mantra, their understanding is that the Gayatri Mantra, including Om, represents either Shiva or the sun god, or sometimes the fire god. Like that. So if they're impersonalist, they chant the Gayatri Mantra with a totally different understanding to what we have. Yeah. It can appear they're chanting even the same mantras, but they don't necessarily, they may not necessarily be worshipping Vishnu. Prabhupada was, it's very common. Prabhupada was talking about Chinmayananda. Anyone heard of Chinmayananda? But Prabhupada was saying that, he preached the Bhagavad Gita a lot, but when he established a temple, it was a big temple, Shiva Linga. So, it's just a whole different conception. So, we get to the end of the chapter here, and we see that the 16th daughter whose name was Sati, was the wife of Lord Shiva, and she could not produce a child, although she was always faithfully engaged in the service of her husband. The reason is that Sati's father, Daksha, used to rebuke Lord Shiva in spite of Shiva's faultlessness. Consequently, before attaining a mature age, Sati gave up her body by dint of yogic mystic power. So this takes us into the Daksha Yajna, which is a it's a very fascinating look at what happens when, you know, there is pride, anger, brahmanas, Vaishnavas, all thrown in together, and things become very chaotic. And you know, various devotees comment upon this section, and they may draw different parallels sometimes to temples, to ISKCON, to the, you know, because, you know, sometimes things get a little bit out of hand. So, you know, it's an interesting chapter to look at. What to do, what not to do. Now, I'll just read a summary. Of this chapter. So, of course, you know, that first chapter, there's a lot of names, you know, there's like hundreds of names, and, you know, they sort of, they go in one ear and out the other, sort of thing like that. But the more you become familiar with the Bhagavatam, you know, the names, you know, it's just like, you know, if you go to a wedding, you go to a wedding and say, oh, are you on the bride's side? Oh, yeah, I'm, you know, the second cousin. You know, if you're in the family, you sort of, it's interesting, you know, you sort of, oh, really, you're related? Oh, okay, you know, like that. Oh, is that what happened? You know? So, you know, but if you're new to that family, it means nothing. You know, someone says, oh, I'm the second cousin of the first uncle, you know, on that side, and you say, you know, you lost me at this and carefully, you know. So, it gradually makes sense, you know. You know, all these little things become quite relishable when, you know, you become more familiar with it. And of course, you know, like a good lawyer or, you know, or a doctor, it's the little details that all add up to something. You know, each and every detail you can find out is extremely important, you know, for your overall assessment of a situation. So, you know, for the layman, they may be looking at something medically, and there are various details they don't consider relevant or important at all. And for a medical person, they're just, whoa, you know, look at that, you know, it's something. So, you know, you have to persevere a little bit with these things, just like someone at the beginning of a medical course or the beginning of a legal course, but, you know, they are relevant, you know, in the long run.
Yeah. What happened in the first 50 years?
Oh, 50 years? 50 years?
I thought that it's, you know, this pasture took place on the day one when Brahma appeared and served the moon.
So,
it's very similar. Because what happens is that the acharyas point out that the most commonly accepted scenario is that in the first day of Brahma, we're coming from a scene of, total devastation. Everything is just totally wound up. And therefore, we're beginning from scratch. And it's called the Padma... Kalpa. Because in the Padma Kalpa, the lotus flower emanates from Garbhodaksha Vishnu there's no lotus flower, and then it emanates and Lord Brahma is there, such as the devastation. That scenario doesn't necessarily play out at the end of every day of Brahma. There is, there are different types of destruction at the end of Brahma's day. At the end of Brahma's day, he goes to sleep. It's quite a substantial devastation. And the change of the manus is also a type of devastation which is even less substantial. But, on the first day of Brahma's life, on the last day of his 50th year, and then on the first day of his 51st year, they are called Padma Kalpas, in which the lotus scenario plays out. See. Otherwise, that devastation between the two halves of Brahma's life is more substantial than what is usually at the end of his night. And they're known as Padma Kalpas. So, the same scenario doesn't play out exactly at the end of every Brahma's day.
It's a bit similar, at the start of his very first day and the first day of his second half of his life. It's a bit
And the last day of his...
The last day of his 50th. Yeah. And first day of his second half.
The name is Padma Kalpa. They're more substantial in, the devastations that take place. And, therefore, things begin from, a far more regressed position.
Yeah.
So, what is being described now, the Srimad Bhagavatam is literally describing to us, the current day of Brahma. And we can understand from this current day of Brahma that it would be very similar to what happened in the first day of Brahma. Or in other Padma Kalpas, like that. But so therefore, it's not here Jagya, an expansion of Vishnu, becomes Indra, but that doesn't happen in every day of Brahma or in every Manvantara. So the special, it's special for this day. All right, I'll read this chapter. I'll read a summary. Buddha inquired, how is it possible that Daksha could be inimical towards such an auspicious personality as Lord Shiva? Right, so, you know, that's intriguing. And we're going to look at that, you know, why Lord Shiva is so auspicious, and then how can someone be so auspicious and then someone's inimical to him? The sage Maitreya explained, when Daksha, the leader of the Prajapatis, entered the assembly of a great sacrifice, seeing his bodily lustre as bright as the effulgence of the sun, all the universal leaders present except Lord Brahma, who's his father, and Lord Shiva stood in respect for Daksha. Daksha was very much offended to see Lord Shiva sitting and was not showing him any respect. Daksha angrily began to speak very strongly against Lord Shiva, criticizing him for failing to respectfully receive him, although as Daksha's son-in-law, he should have done so. Judging Shiva by his external appearance, Daksha described him as shameless, duplicitous, uncivil, impure, dirty, mad, and inauspicious. So he really laid into it. In a fury, Daksha cursed Lord Shiva to be bereft of his share of the oblations of the sacrifice. So then he said, you know, you can't eat with us. Finally, Daksha left the assembly in anger and returned to his home, in spite of the request of assembled members. So Daksha leaves. And they're saying, no, that's a bad move, don't do that. Nandisvara, the follower of Lord Shiva, curses Daksha that he would soon have the face of a goat. He also cursed both Daksha and all the Brahmins present there who had tolerated Daksha cursing Shiva. So, you know, because they tolerated that, they also got a curse. Bhishma, we know Bhishma he had to, ultimately be annihilated, because he was silent when Draupadi was being betrayed. It's actually a very serious offence, especially if there's a Vaishnava, just to remain. You know, there's a Vaishnava apparat. What to speak of just general humanity, someone is being attacked or raped or something they just stand by and allow it to happen. So they don't phone the police or ask someone if they've got it's a very bad thing. Nandisvara cursed both Daksha and the Brahmins present there who tolerated Daksha's cursing Shiva to be bereft of transcendental knowledge, to always remain attached to fruitive activities, to do their duties merely for the purpose of maintaining the body, and to be devoid of discrimination in eating. They will acquire money begging from door to door simply for the satisfaction of the body. So, as we see, Prabhupada mentions, these qualities are there in many Brahmanas, in this day and age. Now, Bhrigu, who's a follower of Daksha, he cursed the followers of Lord Shiva with a very strong Brahminical curse. One who takes a vow to satisfy Lord Shiva will certainly become an atheist and will be diverted from transcendental scriptural injunctions for auspicious advancement. They'll imitate Lord Shiva by keeping long hair on their heads, living on wine and flesh, etc. Now, when such cursing and counter-cursing was going on, Lord Shiva became very morose and silently left the arena of the sacrifice, followed by his disciples. And after completing the sacrifice, the demigods bathed at the confluence of the Ganges and the Jamuna and then departed for their respective abodes. So that's a summary there. What I might do is just get you to just discuss you know, we can have a little bit of a discussion on some of these different points. Okay. Now, in the first point, let's look at why Vidura is so astonished, as you know, someone could be, you know, so upset over Lord Shiva. You know, Lord Shiva is a very gentle person, that he's not envious of anyone. You know, he's equal to everyone. Shiva literally means all auspicious. So, really, no one can be his enemy because he's just a very peaceful, renounced person. He doesn't construct a house for himself, so he's not making big demands. He's not trying to, expand his domain, his, you know, residence and facility. He lives under a tree. He's very detached from worldly things. He's not trying to take other people's things. He's not coveting other people's things. He's the spiritual master of, known as Bhutanath, the worshipable deity of the dull-headed, right, which also indicates ghosts as well. And he reforms ghosts and demons, what to speak of, and as well as godly persons. So therefore he's also known as Vaishnavanam, Yathasambhu, or the greatest of all Vaishnavas. Because he takes charge, you know, of everyone. So, now, why was Daksha intolerant? One, he was the son-in-law. So, he was expecting his son-in-law Shiva to show respect. He didn't stand up. He took it as an insult.
I read in another version that Lord Shiva was actually in trance, but that's not mentioned here. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's mentioned here. Also previously, you know, even before this, Daksha wasn't very happy with his daughter marrying Shiva. He thought that Shiva looked very poor and niggardly. You know. He wasn't well dressed. He wasn't the sort of son-in-law he wanted his daughter to bring home. He thought he was dishonest. Because he accepted the position of his son-in-law, but didn't fulfill that position by being respectful. It was almost like he reneged on, you know, the behaviour he expects. He said that he has eyes like a monkey's. But you've married my daughter whose eyes are like a deer cub.
How did this culture come about? This is given by the tradition that we should have followed, where did you? But actually, the son-in-law never give respect to the father-in-law. It's the
other
way around. The father-in-law always gives respect.
To
the
son-in-law? Yeah. Huh? Hmm? I don't know,
the other
culture
they should tell
me,
but that's how
that, the
tradition is.
Hmm?
The
son-in-law doesn't give respect to the...
No, not about the respect, but it's more of a etiquette, you know. When you treat the guest when they come home, son-in-law is given the highest, guest treatment.
Yeah, one day. He's king for a day. The day he gets married. The day he gets married, he's a king for a day. He can ride a big white horse and put his big hat on with it, like that. But it's one day. I think what's happened is that the grooms are getting carried away. They want that respect every day. But But you know, they get that on their on the wedding day. But
no,
if
the groom goes to the house of the father, he expected any time.
Well, that this is where it's been mistaken. It's on that day, because what happens is that the groom's party goes to the house of the daughter's parents for the marriage, and therefore he's the most respectable guest coming. He's respected above all others. He's the most important person that day.
This happens in India every time the groom comes through.
No, well, you know, that's they have misunderstood, Vedic culture.
You should have known.
Okay. I'll send him an email. We'll send him a letter, we'll all sign it. So you've noticed this as well. You see the difficulty I have with weddings. You sit in the room and you've got the two parents from the bride's side and the groom's side. They've both got traditions which are that far away from Vedic culture. It's not funny. And someone on the groom's side will say, "Oh, we should do like this," and then the parents on the bride's side are just glaring, like that. And then that's the fact. I'm stuck in the middle, I'm trying to, just even understand what they're asking, it's some really weird stuff. And, I had one couple and they wanted to have the deities in such a way that they had their backs to the deities. And I'm saying, well, that's not the way things done. So, but, my friend got married and that's the way they did it, like that, so. You've got to deal with so many different things like this, because from my perspective as a Westerner, it's very difficult because it's actually made quite easy because I just take it from Prabhupada's books, so, and from Shastra. So we have a standard format which is based on Shastra, and I usually say to them, and what I find is, when you explain why we're doing a certain thing, they usually they'll accept it when they understand. That's why in every wedding I always go to the trouble to explain, everything we're doing, in simple terms that people understand. And then they actually quite happily accept it. Just like with the hair cutting, quite often, they'll come and they'll say, "Look, we don't need to do the puja, just do the hair cutting." Or they'll say, "Do the hair cutting and do the worship afterwards." And then, I explain to them that actually it's Lord Vishnu who cuts the hair. The Baba and the priest are both acting as instruments for Vishnu. Actually, Vishnu performs the ceremony and cuts the hair and everything. And everything else is actually the paraphernalia of Lord Vishnu, including the Brahman and the Baba, like that. So, to cut the hair first means that Vishnu has not cut the hair, the uncle has done it. And the whole purificatory process is because Vishnu actually comes and, performs the ceremony through, the priest and what have you. So when you explain that, they go, "Oh, yes, yes, do that, like that." They have no problem. But if you don't explain, they say, "Oh, we've done this for 50 generations, my grandmother, like this." So, it's like that, it's that one day, it's the wedding day, he is the king for a day. After that, what do we call him?
Halt.
Eh?
Halt slave.
Halt.
Don't be mine,
nothing. No, he's... No. What do we say? He is to be compared to Narayan, and the wife is compared to be Lakshmi. That's the ideal they're working towards. That's the idea. If they're working towards that, you know, if they actually, you know, marry properly, then as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am that sex life. You know, that means Krishna or Vishnu becomes, you know, the husband and wife acting on behalf of Lord Vishnu. In the same way as the Brahman and the Baba are acting on behalf of Lord Vishnu, the husband and wife acting on behalf of Lord Vishnu. It's a very noble situation if it's done properly. Still, you know, they shouldn't transgress normal etiquette. So this is the proper etiquette. Eyes like a monkey's. Something a little bit amiss there. He didn't welcome me with sweet words. So he's saying that Lord Shiva is not observing the required rules and regulations. Therefore, he's impure. But I'm obliged. Somehow I was obliged to hand my daughter over to him. So he's obviously, you know, a bit miffed that he didn't really want his daughter to marry Lord Shiva. You know, these are some of the accusations he's making against Shiva. What else does he say? He says he's the most mad and inauspicious creature. You know, he's mad. He goes around naked. He lives in filthy places like crematoriums. His companions are ghosts and demons. Sometimes he's laughing. Sometimes he's crying. You know, he smears the crematorium ashes over his body. He doesn't bathe regularly. He's got skulls and bones ornamenting his body like this. So, you know, he's very inauspicious and crazy like that. Therefore, he's saying he's very dear to other crazy people in the mode of ignorance like that. On the request of Lord Brahma, I handed over my chaste daughter to him. So that's why he gave his daughter. Otherwise, he wouldn't have let his daughter marry him. So he's got a, you know, he's a bit agitated even before. You know, this is an interesting point here, that when someone is agitated, someone's a bit disturbed about another person, then the slightest little fault that they find is going to anger them greatly, because there's already a huge amount of anger and disturbance. So it won't take much. You know, conversely, if a person has a very cordial relationship with someone, they haven't somehow, you know, they have done something that somehow disturb them, then even if there's some big things, they may not be angered very much. But in this case here, you know, Lord Shiva actually hasn't done anything personally to Daksha. So, you know, we can't say that Shiva, you know, boy, he really, you know, mucked up previously with Daksha, and therefore the slightest little thing in Daksha went off. So he deserved it. Here, you know, Lord Shiva actually is despite the fact that his, his character is certainly not what Daksha expected or would have liked, but he hasn't really hurt or harmed him really in any way until this point, you know, where now he considers, okay, I found something, he's disrespected me like that. So, you know, it's an interesting psychology here. Any other comments or questions on that about, you know,
Was it found in the purport that you envious of Lord Shiva's position?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's, let's see, I haven't seen that so far, but did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that
too.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay,
somewhere.
Well, we may get to that. Now, Prabhupada draws a general principle from Daksha's accusations to Lord Brahma, that when one becomes very angry, he forgets everything. Thus, Daksha, in anger, not only accused the great Lord Shiva, but criticised his own father, Lord Brahma, for his not very astute advice that Daksha hand over his daughter to Lord Shiva. So in essence, he's saying, I did it because of Brahma, which means ultimately, you know, what was Brahma thinking? You know? So here, you know, we see how this very consuming anger, this is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita as well, 267, 68, I think it is. 62, 63, second chapter. That when one contemplates the objects of the senses, lust arises. You know, we contemplate something and then we develop a strong desire for that thing we're contemplating. From such lust, anger arises because, you know, there's a frustration that, either the amount of endeavour we have to go to get that thing, or that we can't get that thing, or it's not sufficient as much as what we want. You know, there's some anger like that. And from anger becomes bewilderment of memory. Is that the next one?
Illusion.
Bewilderment of memory first, is it? Bewilderment of memory, because, you know, or is illusion? Okay, so there's illusion. So, you know, there's that frustration, a sense of illusion, or one's touch with reality becomes distorted. If someone wants something bad enough and they're a bit, some anger starts to generate, they tend to see things according to what they want, not according to how things are. So there's a sense of illusion that builds. And then, from that illusion, memory is lost. One literally forgets so many important factors. One's own position, someone else's position, the circumstances, the consequences, how this turned out before, something like that. It just all goes out the window. This is the point Prabhupada is making. In anger, one forgets everything. This is a really important aspect of this whole scenario. And, it's there in the Bhagavad Gita. And, from that, where do we go to? We go to one forgets everything, and then one falls down into the material pool. So, literally one is just completely covered over and, engaged in an activity with, completely under the control of the modes of material nature, and one will then be, completely subjected to the reaction of, which is in Tamagun, is the most harshest type of, reaction like that. So, but this principle of just forgetting everything, starting from some contemplation, some strong desire, gradually building to that point of anger, and that anger, the delusion, and the just total forgetfulness, Sometimes you see someone, even a person of great discrimination, a person of great intelligence or great experience, do something so, you know, unbelievable, you think, I can't believe that person did that. You know, but this is the scenario that just everything is forgotten. You know, that's the... So it's... here he's starting to say things which are, you know, just really forgetting his place and everything. So then, now, Shiva's position, he's accepted, this curse is here, but Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur comments, you know, that Shiva was saved from the calamity of taking part with other demigods who were all materialistic. So Lord Shiva is the greatest devotee of the Supreme Lord. It's actually not fitting for him to eat or sit with materialistic persons like the demigods. Thus the curse of Daksha was indirectly a blessing, for Shiva would not have to eat or sit with other demigods who were too materialistic. So, you know, this is also, here we're seeing, you know, those who become, fall down to the material position, the demigods such as Daksha are acting on the material platform, and it shows, you know, the result of such anger that one can forget everything, such a, you know, a horrible position to be in, you know, that where you've got to the point where everything you need to remember, you can no longer remember. It's a, you know, you're in a dangerous position. That's from the materialist side. And here, from Lord Shiva's side, because he's actually a great devotee, practically he's untouched. And in essence, everything that happens to a devotee is somewhat the blessing of the Lord or the favour of the Lord. So, you know, it means that, okay, he doesn't have to associate with people who, you know, he really shouldn't have to associate with persons on that, you know, sort of gross level, materialistic level, like that. So, Now, what conclusion does Prabhupada give regarding the behaviour of Lord Shiva? The conclusion is that Lord Shiva behaved in his own way to avoid materialistic persons who might disturb him in his prosecution of devotional service. So here Prabhupada's actually saying that not only, you know, it's a blessing in disguise, but that somehow Lord Shiva's intelligence was quite in tune with, you know, perhaps the situations that could unfold, may unfold, and was some, you know, was somewhat intentional in his behaviour, you know, that understanding that there may be some blessing in, you know, things turn out like this, and maybe a blessing in disguise like that. So.
But then at the end, he got up sorry, as you see all the cursing and counter-cursing, and that
he is thinking. Yeah, why was he sorry?
Because he left because he wanted the cursing and counter-cursing to stop. It won't stop unless he left. But maybe all the generations are going to be affected because of that.
Well, Prabhupada says in the purport to verse 33, here Lord Shiva's excellent character is described. In spite of the cursing and counter-cursing between the parties of Daksha and Shiva, because he is the greatest Vaishnava, he was so sober that he did not say anything. A Vaishnava is always tolerant, and Lord Shiva is considered the topmost Vaishnava, so his character, as shown in this scene, is excellent. So here, you know, becoming morose and leaving the arena of sacrifice, Prabhupada is, you know, giving the Vaishnava quality of moroseness. You know, again, you know, one of Prabhupada's disciples, she asked Prabhupada, you know, I think she was showing Prabhupada a photo or something. She said, "Prabhupada, you know, you look so morose in that picture." "I don't." And Prabhupada said, "Morose? That is because you do not know what is ecstasy." So, you know, Prabhupada's taking that moroseness, or, you know, very grave, very sober, you know, very, you know, tough, you know. He certainly doesn't have a lot to jump up and dance about in ecstasy, but, you know, he's very grave and sober and tolerant about the whole situation. It's that sort of moroseness, not on the material platform, but, you know, on the transcendental platform. You know, I think also that when Prabhupada was in Bombay, just before he left to come to America, and there was this holdup. You know, they weren't granting the last documents he needed. You know, there was just so many obstacles, and even up to that point, you know, he was just hanging out to go, and he just couldn't quite get the final document. And you know, some of the people who saw him said that, you know, he appeared to be morose, but, you know, when they questioned him about it, you know, he was describing to them that, you know, you don't understand the transcendental ecstasy of, you know, always, you know, sort of trying to push on, you know, the Lord's, you know, mission. You know, it's, you know, from your position it may appear that I'm very sad and somber and morose, but, you know, it's not like that. You know, you're actually misunderstanding my position like that. And he eventually went in and saw the person and found out that, you know, the junior person who was supposed to stamp his P-form or something like that decided, "Oh, you're too old and, you know, what will you do?" You know, like that. So he didn't do it. And Prabhupada said, "You know, you take me to the superior person." And Prabhupada went in and saw the big manager, and he explained what he was going to do, and he said, "Yes, don't you worry, you know, they understand it like that." And Prabhupada was an exorcist. But, you know, the moroseness of a devotee, you know, if they're properly situated in devotional service, is, you know, not quite the same moroseness as a materialistic person. Now, a very interesting point here is that daksha, this is an extremely important point. The name daksha suggests that he was expert in material activities, but still, because of his aversion towards a saintly person such as Shiva, he was attacked by these three enemies: anger, lust, and passion. Lord Chaitanya therefore advised that one be very careful not to offend Vaishnavas. He compared offences to a Vaishnava to a mad elephant. As a mad elephant can do anything horrible, so when a person offends a Vaishnava, he can perform any abominable action. So, you know, that's another twist on the mad elephant. You know, we often hear the mad elephant offence that, you know, sometimes people say, you know, devotees can commit offences, and there are many offences that are generally tolerated by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu if they're chanting and preaching and pushing on. The Vaishnava Aparad is a different offence. That's the mad elephant offence. We usually hear it in this way, that, you know, you've made the beautiful garden of the creeper of bhakti, and you fence it off and what have you, and let the mad elephant in, and the mad elephant stomps. You know, there's not much left of your garden or your walls or anything. Everything's done like that. But here, Prabhupada's taken the mad elephant as the offender as well. You know, there's not much they won't do. Now, that's another sort of twist on the mad elephant offence. he's taking the mad elephant as the offender themselves. It's not that someone else has come in and stopped their garden, they've done it themselves, by the way. So, you know, and therefore, you know, devotees have to be careful, especially, you know, sometimes devotees may have a long history of many wonderful things they've done. But the mad elephant offense means that that's all trashed. You can't just sit on so many wonderful things done in the past. The mad elephant means that's all being trashed. So it's a very serious offense. This is why, you know, this is a very important section of the Bhagavatam, because of all the things that Vaishnavas need to be aware of. This is, you know, probably, you know, one of the biggest impediments in their whole life as a devotee. So, you know, it's quite a wonderful story. And just all the, you know, who's in the right, who's in the wrong, and, you know, as we were saying, we're looking at etiquette before, you know, we have traditions and things like that. But the Bhagavatam just clears away all the misconceptions of what's acceptable and not acceptable on a material platform and just gets to what is proper according to the Bhagavatam's view. And of course, as we described in the very beginning, we have no purpose to distort the message of the Bhagavatam. Our purpose is to understand it properly and to present that exactly as it is to others in an understandable way. That's our duty. We have no other purpose that let's change it because somehow or another it's disturbing to hear these things, or, you know, for whatever reason. So this is very important. But thank you. So because he was averse to the association of the saintly devotee, he became attacked by anger, lust, and passion. Now, if you want to really, in the Harinam Chintamani, written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, which is the instructions of Haridas Thakur, it actually describes in great detail how Vaishnava apparatus in particular leads step by step to a person literally being on the material platform once again. Like, where's their taste for devotional service, that they're just acting for lust and anger and greed? You know, there's a nice progression in the Harinam Chintamani, if you want to, you know, read a little bit more about the progression. In essence, what happens is that the result is that when the serious Vaishnava apparat, the Lord withdraws the taste from the person's service. So even though they're doing the service, they're not actually deriving the taste anymore. Even if they're doing huge quantity of service, and therefore not deriving a taste from their devotional service or the association with devotees, they then begin to transfer their to derive a taste from material aspects that may be there within the facilities of devotional service, and that then leads to this, anger and greed like that. So, you know, that is progressive. It's nicely described in the Harinam Chintamani. I think we'll just leave it there, you know, at this stage. If anyone has any comments or questions on that, please read this chapter, because, you know, it's just, there's six more chapters to go, I think, six, yeah. And it's a very fascinating story, and it's very, very important to, you know, for the every devotee to understand this pastime. Yep. Yeah, as far as I understand, it's the first day of Brahma's life, the last day of the 50th year of his life. Yeah, and the first day of his 51st year of life. And, you know, possibly the last day of his 100 year. You know. in other words, you know, the day before everything's finished. Yeah, so there's three or four.
And the first chapter when it describes the sentence of Prasuti and Daksha, then it mentions Sati and Shiva, they had no progeny. But we understand that, like, Sati is Durga Devi, Sati is energy,
yes.
And Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva is like the glass of Vishnu when the glass is and impregnates the Deva energy.
Yes. Yes. So here there is Sambhu or Shiva who literally is an expansion from Sankarshan at the very beginning of creation when the Lord glances at the material energy, Lord Shiva in his Sambhu feature appears, and the jivas that are within the glands of the Lord are literally impregnated within the material energy by Sambhu. So that's before there's any universes or what have you. He then expands as the Shiva, you know, within each universe that comes from Brahma's, you know, forehead like that. And then, you know, there are further expansions of Shiva and the Rudras and everything like that. So, and here, in this pastime, we're seeing the pastime of Durga. So she, in the beginning, there is Sambhu and Durga, the personified material energy. The Shiva Linga represents Shiva impregnating the living entities into the material energy. So then both Shiva and Durga expand again, you know, and as, you know, Sati and Shiva here. So these are further expansions. And then Sati will, she, you know, leaves her body, then she comes back, and then, so in different appearances, she may then, you know, give birth to the children and what have you. And then, of course, we know that she also appeared as Krishna's sister. So that is another appearance. So there are different times when Durga Devi does expand in very significant expansions. And, you know, her expansions may for some time be covered or not so present. You know, or not so personified, and you know, as in the case of Krishna's appearance, you know, she made a definite personified appearance at that, and even in Lord Chaitanya's pastime, she makes, as far as I remember, she also makes like a personified appearance. Sadashiva. Yeah. Well, Sadashiva refers to what I understand, you know, Lord Shiva in his original feature in his eternal abode, you know, which is Shiva Dham, Mahesh Dham, which resides between the material and spiritual abode. That's my understanding of Sadashiva, that it's him in his eternal abode there, you know, between the two, material energy and the spiritual energy. And, that Sadashiva then may expand.
It becomes the glance, basically, or he further impregnates.
Yes, and that Sadashiva has a relationship with Advaita Acharya as well.
Sorry?
With Advaita Acharya, because Advaita Acharya is Mahavishnu in one of his features. Yeah, Mahavishnu has two features, and Advaita Acharya represents one of those, so it's non-different. And that one that he represents is somehow related to Sadashiva. By empowering the material energy to produce its ingredients.
Yeah.
Because we know that the material energy, it produces the gross material elements, you know, it produces the material elements, and ultimately a lot of that is represented by some, you know, the Shiva, the presiding demigod of the false ego. So, you know, therefore there's a relationship between Mahavishnu, when he produces the material elements, and, you know, Lord Shiva, who's the dominating deity at that time. All right, we've got 2 minutes to go. Right, 1 minute over. We can photocopy some pages for you. What I might do is I might go and photocopy them, and then you know, I'll be here for about an hour or so, an hour and a half or something, and if you see me, I can give you a copy. Otherwise I might just pass the whole bunch of them to you know, Bhakti Sa, and then, you know, you can just, when you see Bhakti Sa, you can just you know, pick up a copy and, you know, like that. What it is, you know, it's this unit, the summaries of the chapters, the questions that you, you know, homework questions to see if you can answer, and analogies, and perhaps there's this table of what we discussed today, the genealogical table of the daughters of Manu, and I might put in there the essay questions, you know, four essay questions.
So,
just unit 11 has a
question
for
unit
10. My understanding was unit 10 was only the presentation. Can we do that next week? Okay. Yeah? Hold that question. Can I park? I think I've reached my limit. Are you going to be here for a little while? Are you going to the city at all?
No.
So I can give you the copies once I've had a copy of them?
Yeah.
Where will you be?
I think
the subject,
I can come and
meet
you.
Okay.
Are you taking the money for the
handbook? Yeah, yeah, no, I'll write it down, okay.
Is that cheap?